Okay, so today, right from last week, in our passage last week, the author of Hebrews shows us that Jesus Christ is a priest of an order that is superior to the Levitical priesthood. In Jesus Christ, we have a priest, a high priest, who was appointed by an oath sworn by the Lord, who is the Son, and who entered the heavenlies, and who ever lives to intercede on behalf of his people. Affirming those conclusions, our passage today begins with kind of an echoing of what it is that he started out with earlier in chapter 7. He begins with by saying, we have such a high priest. But there might be some that are still not convinced. For instance, like, aren't the old ways the better ways? Is this what it is that the author of Hebrews is talking about and what it is that we've been going through? Is this just some kind of innovation, some sort of progressivism that's working out? You know, what about the traditions that are comfortable for us, the traditions that helped us identify with a community and to understand our place in the world? And, you know, can't we just move forward with Jesus and yet keep the old things that are comfortable and validate who it is that we think about ourselves and what we believe about ourselves? The answer is no. No, you can't. As we're moving further into our life, walking with the Lord, we have to leave behind the old ways. The old ways that we've lived. We're not going to make it through the desert, the wilderness of this world, if we are looking back over our shoulder, trying to drag all of that old with us. The author of Hebrews, he tells us that we have a better hope through which we draw near to God. The point is this: how is it that we will make it if we are merely trying to live our old life over again in this new life? How will we make it if we live that way? We'll only make it if we fully enter into the new. And as we look at Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 to 13, we're going to be looking at this context of the old and the new. That language is used over and over again. What does that mean? Secondly, the better hope of the new. And thirdly, the danger of making the new old, and the way in which I imagine that is an old with an E on the end of it. Maybe you've been somewhere. When I grew up in Ohio, we used to go visit a place called Ye Old Mill, you know. So it's kind of taking something new and kind of, you know, making it curious or whatever. But we don't want to do that. We don't want to make the new old. Janie Hughes is now going to come forward and read our passage.
Sermon text from this morning is from Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 through 13. Now, the point in what we are saying is this: we have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. For he finds fault with them when he says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. not like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete, and what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. This is the word of the Lord.
Okay, firstly, let's look at this context, this language about the old and the new. The discussion about the old and the new covenants can be difficult for us to understand and to place kind of in the history of the scriptures and God's revelation. To understand what's being discussed, to understand its significance, we've got to first understand what a covenant is. Though we liken this idea of covenant maybe to something like a contract or a treaty, that doesn't adequately describe what a covenant is. A covenant is an unbreakable promise. A theologian has defined a covenant as a bond in blood, sovereignly administered. It's a great definition. A covenant is a bond in blood, sovereignly administered. Right, in this definition, right, a covenant is enacted by a sacrifice. There's the blood. And determination of the fulfillment of the covenant is made by God sovereignly. Now, the Hebrew word for covenant, berit, is connected with this idea of cutting. You had to cut a covenant. That is, that a sacrifice was made. We should also note that these covenants were things that were being practiced in the ancient Near East by many other nations at the same time outside of Israel. It was a common practice by the time the covenant is enacted with Abraham. In fact, it's an example of where God actually condescends and makes use of means that would have been familiar to help his people understand what it is that he is doing and what it is that he is promising. Now, as to the kind of promise that a covenant is, I think that all of us have imagined the existence of a thing that is an unbreakable vow. But we've never seen those things play themselves out or lived out. Right, a covenant is different from an agreement or a contract because deals and contracts can be renegotiated or canceled. But a covenant is a thing that is binding until death. In this way, we speak of marriage as being a covenant, right? Because the bride and the groom, they promise to keep their vow until death do us part, right? And they also make these promises before God, in the name of God, right? So that it's sovereignly administered, right? The consequence for covenant breaking is very, very serious. In the scriptures over and over again, covenant breaking results in the death of the one who has broken the covenant. A covenant is a thing that's called a self-maledictory oath. And maybe when you were a young kid, you made self-maledictory oaths when you promised to your friend, cross my heart, hope to die. What? Who says that? Stick a needle in my eye? That's worse! Right? But that's a self-maledictory oath. And that assures the person that you're promising that you're telling the truth or that you're going to do what it is that you promise. Right, to break a covenant is a very serious thing. If one fails to keep the covenant, right, that covenant then is not something that is damaged, it is something that is broken. Now, when God made his promise to Abraham to bless him and to bless the nations through him, the Lord made an unbreakable promise. He alone vowed, and that's the significance of what God does with Abraham and Abraham in Genesis chapters 12, 15, and 17. God alone made the covenant. And as Michael showed us a couple weeks ago, God swore on himself to accomplish what was promised and required. Now, when you think about a covenant, most often we probably think of covenants as being some, here's a technical word, bilateral. That is between two people, right? And what we're saying is, if you do this, then I will do this, right? Between two people, and it's conditional upon both people keeping the promises. Now, the Lord's covenant with Abraham, though, was unilateral. That is, God says to Abraham, not if you do this, I will do this. God just says to Abraham, I will do this, period. Now, because the Lord's promise to Abraham was not conditioned upon Abraham's performance, we call it the covenant of grace. And that's over and against the covenant with which the Lord made with Adam, in which the Lord said to Adam, do this and live, or you put it another way, if you eat that, you will die. That was a covenant of works. And every human ever born, whoever will be born, this side of the second coming of Christ, is obligated under the terms and conditions of that covenant, the covenant of works, merely because they've been born. It is the covenant of citizenship of a member of the human family. Now, the problem for us is that because Adam stood as a representative of all of those who would follow after him, all of his progeny, right? All of his progeny stand condemned because Adam broke the covenant. All of us bear the consequences of his covenant faithlessness, his covenant breaking. Now, we know that this is true. We know that this is true because no one has emerged unscathed by the word of God's judgment. We read about chapter 4. All have and all will die. The story of the Bible, the story of the giving and unfolding, is a story of the fulfilling of the covenant of grace. It is the one story of the Bible. What is the Bible about? It is the story of God's grace coming to the nations, coming to all people, God blessing the people through Abraham's descendant. Now, within the covenant of grace, there's this other story that begins to unfold, this unfolding of a story. And in that covenant, the story tells about how God chose for himself a people through whom he was going to fulfill his promise to Abraham as to how it is that he would draw the nations to himself and bless the nations. The Lord, through the hand of Moses, delivered the sons of Jacob, the son of Isaac, the son of Abraham from bondage in Egypt, and at Mount Sinai made a covenant with the descendants of Jacob, with Israel, prior to their entering into the promised land. And Israel, as a people, Similarly, as Adam as an individual was not able to keep the terms of the covenant. Right? Though they bore the marks of the blessed descendants of the children of Abraham by their circumcision, and though they enjoyed the presence of the dwelling place of God through the tabernacle and in the temple, God's plan to bless the nations through them was actually frustrated by them. The very people that he had called to communicate the grace and the mercy of God, to carry forth that purpose. And as the prophet Jeremiah witnessed the unmaking of a nation, as Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar came and conquered Jerusalem and took the people into exile, Jeremiah was given a word of hope regarding the coming of something new. And in this point, right, the preacher's teaching, this is the point of the preacher's teaching here in Hebrews. Something more was needed, and it shouldn't be a surprise to us, right? The Lord's covenant with Moses, with the people of Israel, was not the culmination of the covenant of grace with Abraham. It was merely a shadow of the promised fulfillment that was to come. Now, how do we know that under Moses, right, that covenant was incomplete or imperfect? Well, he's been telling us. Because the high priest appointed to offer sacrifices on behalf of the people had to offer sacrifices for himself first. Because when Moses wrote down the instructions for the construction of the tabernacle, he was writing down a copy based upon the pattern that he saw. It was not the thing, it was merely the shadow of the real thing. Right? If the old had been enough, why then did the Lord, through Jeremiah specifically, and the prophets generally, speak of longing and looking for something new? Thankfully, there is a better hope, and it's the better hope of the new. How is it better? Let's look at a couple of these. I've mentioned kind of them in passing a little bit. But firstly, what makes the better hope, right, the new, the better hope, is that the old is only a copy of the true tabernacle. That's the first one. It's a copy of the way things are, but it's not the thing itself. All of the items in the tabernacle and the temple, they pointed to a reality. But the Lord does not dwell in a house built by the hands of men, right? He can't be contained within a temple, but his throne is the center of the universe. The Lord is sovereign over justice and mercy. He sits upon it. That's his throne, justice and mercy. The Lord gives light and bread, but he's veiled to us right now. And for our sakes, actually, until we are transformed and made like him. But for you to find yourself on the inside in the presence of the Lord, it is both the holiest thing that you could ever experience and the most glorious of privileges to be in the presence of the Lord. So it's only a copy. The old is only a shadow of what of the things that were to come. All of the Old Testament points to Jesus Christ, who is the high priest and mediator of the real thing, right? The old was only a shadow. The theologian B.B. Warfield has said this about the Old Testament. He says, the Old Testament is a room richly furnished, but dimly lit. A room richly furnished, but dimly lit. Jesus Christ is the one who illuminates all that has gone before. And when you see who Jesus is, you can see all of the Old Testament and what it is that it means and how it is that it points it. Jesus gives significance to the meaning of everything that has happened previously. So it's a shadow. Thirdly, the ministry of the old is inferior. The high priest is merely a man who first has to make sacrifice for himself before he may intercede for the people. And the high priest is eventually going to die. His ministry is going to come to an end. And the high priest was never finished offering sacrifices again and again and again. Though he could do this work of entreating the Lord's mercy on behalf of the people, the high priest never secured forgiveness, the wiping away of the debt. The old covenant's promises are also inferior. God's promise to give the land to Israel was conditioned upon Israel's obedience. They broke the covenant and were sent into exile. Those in the new, those who are the meek, who are the disciples of Jesus, what is their inheritance? You remember your Beatitudes? The meek shall inherit the earth. Fifthly, the old covenant only exposed fault. It couldn't make things better, right? The law only shows you what it is that you've done wrong. It doesn't turn you into a good person, right? If you misapply the law and make it into a means by which you might become righteous, it will ruin you. Right? And talking about the covenants, this is where most people, they go wrong. They think of the Ten Commandments that they themselves were the covenant of works rather than that covenant with Adam at the very beginning. That's wrong, right? The people of Israel, they were a part of the unfolding of the covenant of grace. And you'll remember that the preamble to the beginning of the Ten Commandments begins with, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. That is, the first thing was God's grace and his mercy and saving his people and drawing them to himself, right? The obedience to the Ten Commandments was living out of the reality of that grace. But there's a problem. Words that are written on tablets of stone cannot change stone hearts. Words written on tablets of stone cannot change hearts of stone. Right? To look at the law as a means by your becoming righteous, by your vindicating yourself, by your feeling good about who you are and what it is that you've done, is like you're looking at an X-ray to heal your broken arm. You could stare intently at that X-ray. You could really hope that that X-ray would be able to fix your broken arm, but it is not going to touch your broken arm. It is only going to tell you that your arm is broken. It doesn't offer healing. Right? The law is a beginning, but something more has to happen. Right? The Israelites had been, you know, the men had been circumcised, but the circumcision that the Lord was looking for was a circumcision of the heart. Sixth, the old covenant is obsolete and fading away. In fact, you know, up to the day that the letter to the Hebrew was being written, that obsoleteness and fading away had been going on for 400 years. The children of Israel had been scattered across the Mediterranean. They were exiled by the Babylonians, oppressed by the Greeks, conquered by the Romans, and now they were being ruled by a puppet king. Right? The old was meant to prepare them for the real thing that was to come. It was a shadow, but it's become obsolete. It was always meant to be fulfilled in the true high priest and king who is the image of the invisible God, whose light illumines the identity of our founder and finisher. We have a better hope. Our failure of hope is a failure to imagine the marvelous beauty and promises of God. It's a failure to believe those things. Our failure of hope is an inability to apprehend the great love of God. Our failure in hope is to think too lightly of the holiness of God. Our failure of hope is to think too little of the ministry of Jesus Christ on our behalf, both in what it is that he's accomplished and how it is that what it is that he's done for us impacts our present reality. And consequently, our future, how it is that we live and what we're hoping for in our future. Right? Those of us who are traveling through this wilderness, through the wilderness of this world, this between from being rescued from sin and death and going into life, must not forget that we have not arrived yet. That this world is not our destination. This brings us right to this danger, the danger of making the new into something old, you know, kitschy, sentimental. How do we make the new into something old? The first way you do that by making the new old is by believing that this world and its blessings are the real world. You remember your Harry Potter, maybe some of you? You remember in the first book in the Sorcerer's Stone? Or the Sorcerer's Stone? There's a mirror. Do you remember that mirror? Do you remember the name of the mirror?
Erised.
Do you know the significance of the name Erised? It's desire spelled backwards. It is a reflection. It is a mirror image. It is not the same thing as the real thing. Now, for you, have you considered that your desires, those things for which you long, are really merely, not, I mean, they're good things. They can be good things. But can you imagine that these things that you desire, have you considered that they are really only the reflections of the true longings of your heart? It's very difficult for Harry in the Sorcerer's Stone to let go of the opportunity of returning again and again to the mirror of Erised, where he is able to see, he's an orphan, where he is able to see his parents whom he's never met, and to gaze into that mirror and to see that for which he has longed, which is him with his parents. It's very easy for him to gaze upon his mother and father's reflection in the mirror. But it is not the real world. Right? The first way we make the old, the new old, is by believing that this world and what it has to offer, right, that it, the blessings of this life are the real world. They are really the mirror image of the true world. The second way we make the new into something old is when we give ourselves to someone or something that we believe can heal or make us better. Right? We do this in relationships. We do this with friends, parents, children, spouses, counselors, pastors, politicians, anything. Right? If you make anyone or anything into the mediator of what you imagine is going to be the blessing you're pursuing afterwards, it's going to ruin you or them. If you throw yourself into a political candidate or into your children's successes or into your counselor or your career, those things will buckle under the weight of your hope and expectation. They will fail you ultimately. They always, C.S. Lewis says, break the hearts of those who worship them. Thirdly, we make the new old when we exchange the better hope for a nearer relief. Right? Nothing that you could hope for in this life will ultimately satisfy you. You just need to hear that. You've heard me tell the story that I was going to write a book, and the book's title was It All Started When I Turned 16, because I thought that when I turned 16, I would get my driver's license, and somehow I would just magically turn into the person that I imagined that I was, right? That I would be popular, independent. I'd have the courage somehow to ask girls out on dates, which, you know, I didn't up to that point. Somehow having a driver's license was going to change all that. But, you know, I got the driver's license. I didn't have a car. You know, so showing up with a Ford LTD station wagon, you know, to pick up your date, that doesn't look so good, so you got to get a job. And then you got to pay for insurance. And then you're spending so much time working, right? You're tired. You don't want to do those things. And you think, well, if I just graduate, once I get out of the house, graduate, go to high school, then I will finally be the person that I've always imagined myself to be. And then you go to college. And then the question is, what are you going to major in? It's like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to major in. I changed my major 3 times in 1 week. That involved going to the registrar and declaring my major 3 times, drove my parents nuts. All right, I thought if I had a major, you know, then I would finally arrive. And then I thought, you know, if I had a girlfriend in college, and then, if I got a new girlfriend in college, thankfully, who was this girlfriend, and then I was happy, and then everything's been perfect. Everything that I imagined was going to bring me to that place that I thought my parents were, which was arrived, has never come. And I'm standing before you as a post-50-year-old man telling you that I have not arrived yet. I am still looking. Nothing that you can hope for in this life will ultimately satisfy you. Your contentment is something that is offered to you through Christ and can be yours whether you have plenty or you are in want. There's no achievement that you could achieve or accomplish or thing that you could get or place that you could arrive at that will ultimately give you rest. It will never be good enough. Fourthly, we make the new old when we live believing that I'll get what I want by doing what I think will get me what I want. I know that maybe, let me say that again. I will get what I want by doing what I think will get me what I want. That is, when we live thinking that if I can just do whatever it is that I want, then I will be happy. If I can just express myself in whatever way that I want, that I will be a free person. Or, if I can just be good enough so that people will be happy with me and no one can find any fault, and no blame can be laid at me, right? Then I will be a good person. My conscience will be free from the nagging sense that I am not good enough. There's a movie that Jennifer and I really like, but we don't recommend movies, called Enchanted April. And in it, there's a young wife, and her name is Lottie. And Lottie lives oppressed by trying to live up to other people's expectations, especially her husband. She writes down everything that she does, and she keeps meticulous records of her charitable contributions and her good works in a little notebook. And she confides to a friend in a moment of broken vulnerability, right? Desperately, she says, I have been doing things for others ever since I was a little girl, and I don't believe I'm any better. Can you imagine what that's like? You have to stop believing that you know how to get what it is that you want, and start believing and putting your faith in the one who knows what you need and can give you your heart's desire. Sixth, we make the old new by believing that we've arrived. Now, you can see the ways in which you think that you've arrived. They manifest themselves in the moments when you behave like a jerk. When you look down on others, when you make fun of other people's faults or exasperated by their shortcomings, you've forgotten the circumstances from which God rescued you. I had a friend once who, as we were talking, he was talking about kind of the burdens of leadership, and he was complaining about people who didn't like his leadership, and they were always grumbling about it. And I'll just use my name. I just said, "Well, who do you think you are, Randy Sunshine?" Because he was doing the very thing that he was complaining about other people, you know, he was complaining about what other people are doing. Right? We have to remember, all of us were slaves in the kingdom of darkness at one time. Have we forgotten the kindness of our master who, as in the parable, who hired us at the end of the day, and yet we received a full day's wages? Are we standing aloof from the Father who has welcomed home again that knuckle-headed brother of ours? We've forgotten, right, the true son and elder brother who went looking for us, and when he found us, was imprisoned and condemned to death and gave his life in our place to save us, right? That's where you need to be reconnecting. But you forget that, you make the new, you trade the new for something old. Friends, how is it that we're going to make it into the new if we don't put our faith and trust in Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, who was perfectly obedient as you and I should have been, and who died a cursed death in our place because we were covenant breakers? Right? By the renewing grace of the Holy Spirit, the Lord writes now his law on soft hearts. That's what Jeremiah is saying. Made new through his new creation and resurrection life. And he takes us all together as his own. Right? He gives us wisdom and knowledge that we might know him, whether we are small or great. And we will know the fullness of his mercy. Right? Because he says to us that he will remember our sins no more. As the worship team comes forward, we're going to respond. And let me just use this kind of transition to remind us with the exhortation of the author of Hebrews, what he says in Hebrews 3 when he says, "Therefore, holy brothers and sisters, you who share in the heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses also was faithful in all God's house. For Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of a house has more honor than the house itself. For every house is built of someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant to testify to the things that were spoken later. But Christ is faithful over God's house as a son. And we are his house. We are the ones in whom his spirit dwells. If we indeed hold fast." Let's respond by singing, and let this be our confession as we turn to him.